morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host, Fridays and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Atul Gawande, chief surgical resident at a Boston hospital, and also a columnist for The New Yorker magazine. We're discussing his book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Uncertain Science. Atul, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
For the people who have not read the book, perhaps maybe to get them interested in reading the book, might be helpful if you began with a 2-3 minute overview of what you see as the principal themes of Complications.
Well, I guess what I would say is that this is a book, on one level, just about patients that I've taken care of, some of whom have had great saves, some of whom have died, and trying to understand what it is that happens in medicine that explains what happens to people, how the decisions are made, how good decisions are made and bad decisions are made, and then begin to understand both the perfection and imperfection of medicine so that we can begin to grasp what it takes to have people be made better and also have people understand what it's like when you both to be a doctor and also to be a patient in what has become an extremely complex both profession and complex way of taking care of people. In a sense, we've reached a very important juncture in medicine. Medicine's become really powerful and complex and bewildering, but it extends people's lives for everything from heart attacks to cancer to even depression. And on the other hand, the notion that doctors are gods is really long gone. And so people are being expected to take medical decisions into their own hands, make decisions for themselves, and not do simply what doctors tell them to do. But I don't think anyone's prepared them for this. No one's really shown how medicine works, what decisions matter, how they're made, and how much uncertainty there is in how it is dealt with. And so that's what I try to show in this book, the stories with real cases of how things go right and things go wrong, and then why.
Okay, so in some sense, this book is written as much and perhaps more for patients as it is for doctors.
Absolutely. It's really written, I didn't try to write this for patients or for doctors specifically. I just tried to write it in a way that partly for myself and partly for anyone to understand. So that I wanted stories that people would be drawn into, and then ideas that would seem surprising or startling to anyone who would pick it up. And I think what I was drawn to really is the same thing that keeps me interested in medicine, and that is how fundamentally human an endeavor it is. You know, when we think about medicine today, I think what we think about is all the knowledge and powerful technology and abilities of modern 21st century medicine. But I think what you find when you get in close is a much messier, much more fragile reality of an individual doctor and patient sorting through it all. And that's what I wanted people to be able to begin to see.
As I read the book, too, it seems to me that you're wanting to talk both about certain kinds of uncertainty in the nature of medicine itself, and then a great deal has to do with the uncertainty of particular physicians. I wonder if we might talk about the first.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the fact that we are currently ignorant of at least some details of the nature and causes of a number of medical conditions, including some that are really very common.
Yeah.
And at least a couple that I thought were very interesting, which you spent a fair amount of time discussing, was pain and nausea,
mm-hmm.
Something that everyone is familiar with both, and yet medicine
and
finds itself unsure, at least, about certain features of both of the conditions. So I wonder if you could talk about that for a bit.
Well, there are certainly the number one and two reasons that people go to see doctors is pain and nausea, and in my effort to try to understand why it is that things don't necessarily turn out the way people expect them to, there are three reasons for it. One is just our own fallibility as physicians. Another is the inherent uncertainty that there is in taking care of individual people. But the third is this area that we're talking about now, which is that there are still holes in the science, and they're not necessarily only in the obscure, rare conditions. You have conditions like chronic pain. The story I tell is of a Massachusetts architect, a man Massachusetts Medical School, and while working on a zoo project, fell off of a platform and ended up injuring his shoulder. Sometime after that, he started to develop terrible back pain, even though his shoulder was eventually fixed. And that back pain just got worse and worse and worse until he was more or less completely disabled. He lost his architectural firm. He became housebound. And the question is, why? What was going on in this man's back? And yet, no matter how many x-rays he got, MRIs, nothing structurally wrong with his back could be found. And this is, in fact, a very common problem, this that back pains, serious back pains, aren't necessarily explained by the x-rays that you find of their backs. And trying to understand what it is we understand about pain and don't understand, and then what people do about that. Half of what's interesting is what doctors do in situations where things are not well understood. You know, a surgeon operates, a medical physician prescribes, and out of all of it, people may bounce from person to person but never get better. And a large part is because sometimes our treatments aren't particularly good. And in the case of pain, there's all kinds of fascinating science to show why many of the things we do just don't work for most people.
Well, now, let me ask you, in the case of pain, you said that what tends to happen is if someone comes, they have a condition, for example, a problem with pain, a surgeon is going to be inclined to engage in surgery to figure out what the problem is. A regular physician may be inclined to simply give some kind of prescription. I mean, I'm just asking whether you think this is right, that perhaps the problem is a bit on both sides, that some physicians may be wary of saying, I don't know. And conversely, many patients may expect the doctor to know even when they don't. In fact, may even in some level demand that they know.
Absolutely. You have a reluctance on our part to admit in situations where we really don't know well what's going on. It's also that in situations where there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty, you do what you know how to do well. And every surgeon has had the back patient who gets better after their surgery, even if there's a large percentage that don't necessarily, and that's what keeps you going. At the same time, you have all of this knowledge and science and research showing, for example, there's these classic studies that Henry Beecher did during World War II. He was a Mass General physician who was sent out to the war, and he was astounded by the fact that he would see young men with terrible injuries, legs blown off, gaping wounds, that would not need narcotics for pain. And yet people with much smaller injuries in civilian life would require much larger doses of morphine and other kinds of pain medication. And what he found is that the brain helps modulate how we feel pain, and in the terrifying situation of war, that people would actually experience less pain than others. Or there were other studies showing that ballet dancers learn to actually not experience pain despite having chronic injuries. They just don't even feel the pain. Their pain sensitivity is gradually reduced. And the fact that the brain can make such a difference in how pain occurs means that the mind plays a role. And physicians can often be dismissive about this fact. Sometimes they'll just say, well, your pain, it's all in your head. Go see a psychiatrist and don't bother me. But trying to find some way of talking to people about the fact that a pain may actually represent a portion of the brain going haywire, and having a almost normal sensations transmitted to your brain in the form of intense pain can be very confusing for the doctors as well as for the patients. And yet almost all of the successful therapies that are being developed now are medications that help change how the brain interprets pain more more than what goes on in your back or your shoulder or other places where chronic pains can develop.
Okay, so perhaps one of the ways of understanding what this phenomenon shows is that, and this is surely an overused word today, but that medicine has to look at people a bit more holistically, that you can't simply say to a person whose shoulder is hurting, well, there must be a cause of that pain in your shoulder, or else it's just in your mind.
That's right. You have to look at not only the person more holistically, you also have to look more holistically at medicine itself. So you have the person whose sources of a pain or a nausea are going to be much more complex in many instances than just something you can cut out just like that or make go away with a pill when it comes to, say, chronic pains and things like that. And on the other hand, you also have the complexity of recognizing that what we do in medicine can go wrong and there are risks and benefits involved, but also all kinds of ways in which, as a physician and as a patient, you have to be prepared for the fact that there's that the unexpected can happen. That what we do nowadays is so complex that that we have to be, we can't be cavalier about what it is we propose, and so you end up having kind of view in which you begin to understand how both the fact that medicine is provided by ordinary people doing a series of very complex things that yet at the same time somehow extraordinarily does pull together and does make people better in many, many instances. And yet there are those other times when there are complications, when or just things don't work the way that you have expected or hoped that they will. And so being able to think holistically both about the patient and where their problems may be originating from, and then about our solutions and how far they can go and how far they can't go, is the real hard trick to being not only a doctor but to being a patient.
Okay, let's sort of move to the second element that you talk about, that individual physicians, that there may be the scientific and medical knowledge and skill out there, but that individual physicians may lack that skill or lack that knowledge. And one particular point on which you spend a fair amount of time, and I thought it was especially interesting, was your discussion of training.
Mm-hmm.
The training of new docs, and if you will, the retraining of current doctors.
Yeah.
Why is that so important for physicians and for patients to understand?
Well, part of our incredible success in medicine is that we are constantly changing and that there is new science, new technologies, new ways of doing things. And yet the complexity in it is that because there's always new ways of doing things, there's always something new to learn. I was talking to my father. My father's a surgeon. I write about him in the book. He's a urologist. And I grew up in a rural town in Ohio called Athens. And he's the only doctor for, only urologist for at least 50 miles in any direction. And he's been practicing urology for 30 years. And I said, you know, how is it that when there's new technologies and things, you learn to do what you do? And he said, well, you know, that's the existence of my life, that 75% of what he does today, he was never taught to do in medical school or in his surgical training. He has to go out and learn it on his own. And so he's learned to use lasers. He's learned to do microsurgery. He's learned to use all kinds of equipment that never existed when he started his practice. And the only way he could learn to do that is, yes, he goes to conventions and he goes to training sessions and so on. But in the end, most of all, he learns from the same way that I learn as a resident, which is doing things with people for the first time. It's practicing on people. And we all want progress and perfection without practice. So we tend to hide how all that happens. It makes us nervous. It certainly makes me nervous talking about those moments when you just you're still struggling and uncertain about how to do something new. And yet, at the same time, it's important for everybody to understand that, that just because something is new and studies show it can be very promising in the hands of people who are experienced at it, there is a learning curve for all of us at a given task. And doctors have to learn like everybody else.
Okay, so there are really a couple of things going on here. One is, and this seems to me to be very important, people that may not realize it, is that the training that goes on, the learning that goes on, is not something that's just done once when someone is an intern or a resident. It's something done throughout a person's career. Or if it's not done throughout their career, then there's something wrong with them if they aren't learning.
That's right. Yeah, you know, the one solution that someone like my father could have taken was just to do those things that he was familiar with. But that would have meant that the people in our community would have been denied the benefit of the new laser technologies, of minimally invasive surgeries that have replaced having wide open wounds and for a whole lot of illnesses. And so progress and the benefit of it could only happen with him and any other doctor taking steps to really learn and practice and keep on that way. You know, I always imagine that what happens is in your career as a surgeon, you go through training, and then maybe over the next 5 years you continue to climb the learning curve, and then at some point it plateaus and you're at the peak of your skills for the rest of your career, and then maybe as you get a little too old it declines a little bit and you retire. But instead what he described to me is that there are certain things like that for him. But then for a lot of other things, there's just a new learning curve every year. There's always something new that you're starting out a novice on, and that's both what's exciting about medicine and surgery and doing what we do, but also nerve-wracking.
And an important part of what you're talking about when you're talking about learning is not just learning facts, not just learning anatomy, not just learning how a drug works, but learning how to interact with the patient, and particularly in the case of a surgeon, to actually do the surgery.
Yes, it's learning on all kinds of levels, even after you've learned to do technically what you need to do. There's the matter of learning, well, you know, if you've used a new piece of equipment, how do you clean it afterwards? How often does it need to be replaced? Where's it going to be stored? How many people have to be trained besides the surgeon with handling it? And that's just a little piece of equipment. Now let's say you talk about an entire new operation, and then you have everybody from the nurses needing to learn how to take care of the patient 3 days after surgery. The patient goes home and calls with questions, and someone needs to be able to know the answers to those new questions that may not have been anticipated before.
But one of the things you talk about a fair amount in the book is that although these new advances, the new techniques, in the long run are going to be beneficial to people with a condition, that for the first group of patients on whom it's tried, on who the surgeon learns, it may actually be detrimental.
This is the tragic paradox of success in medicine. I tell the story of a major, incredible heart operation for children who are born with all the connections wrong in their heart. These are children these are the blue babies who would die within a few days after birth. And there was a relatively simple procedure. I mean, they're all hard procedures, but comparatively simple procedure that cardiac surgeons learned to do that could keep these kids alive into their 20s. And it's an amazing thing, but it was also incredibly tragic because those kids would grow into adulthood but not often see old age. And then the science came along and the technology to allow the surgeons to actually restore all the normal connections in the heart and let these kids grow up to live a complete normal length of life. And so the surgeons at the best hospital in England, the Great Ormond Street Hospital, actually tracked what happened when they switched from the old operation to the new operation. And what they found was that the mortality rate for the first 30 or 40 kids was skyrocketed. It was as high as 20%, much higher, triple what it was with the old operation. But after that, the mortality rate plummeted to the point that it was very clear that by going through that learning stage, that all the remaining kids went on to live far longer lives than they ever would have been possible. My own son is a beneficiary of this kind of learning. When my son was born with a cardiac defect, and when I was in my first year of residency, we were confronted with the question of whether the surgeon should go ahead and do an operation that was still relatively new, but he had done it on other kids before. We knew the old operation wasn't great. We wanted the chance at the new operation, but we're scared about, you know, the learning curve. But in the end, we were very lucky that, things worked out as they did, because my son got through the operation, and he has every prospect of living a completely normal length of life.
But even in that case, as you described it, the doctor had already done at least a few cases of the surgery.
That's right. And we are now in the situation where my son needs a second operation. And we'll need a second operation in the next couple of years. And there is he needs a replacement for his aorta in his chest. And there is the traditional techniques, but there are new techniques which are just coming out now. And people are encouraging us to try the new technique. And I'll be honest, I'm very much on the fence about taking on something new that has to last him the next 60 years of his life, and not knowing if this is going to be the tested and true way that will work for him, and you know, we still are going to be struggling over the next year over this question of whether to do the very new thing or stick with the old ways and its known complications, which some of which can be serious. You know, there aren't good answers, and that's why these are dilemmas and paradoxes and tremendously heart-wrenching. And a big part of the reason why I wanted to write the book is to help people understand, number one, there aren't black and white answers here, but number two, to see how it is that people make these decisions. And I show people making decisions, and some of them do make these decisions wisely, and you can learn a lot from them. And then you can also learn from some of the people who I think didn't make these decisions so wisely. Sometimes they're doctors, and sometimes they're patients, and you begin to see what has happened.
We're going to have to skip over some issues just because we are running out of time. I wonder, in the last 5 minutes, if you can talk a little bit about this idea of sort of the necessary fallibility of the practice. And one of the cases, it seems to me, that comes up, I mean, sometimes you can talk about fallibility in general, but certainly sometimes fallibility occurs even in cases where you might know in the abstract what needs to be done, but the problem is the press of time simply doesn't permit you to go through and think about all the alternatives.
Yeah.
Or even if you did, it might end up leading it to the wrong conclusion. And it seemed to me that your case of Eleanor was especially illustrative at this point. Mm-hmm. What would you want to say about this general problem of the fallibility of medicine and of doctors?
You talked about the case of Eleanor Bratton. She's a 23-year-old who came in the emergency room, and she had a red leg. And the thought entered my mind, almost for irrational reasons, that this may not be an ordinary skin infection. I was referred to see her. It was a red and angry portion of her leg that had started as a little foot wound. She didn't know if it came from dancing barefoot at a wedding she'd been at, or from a pedicure she'd gotten. But all we knew is her leg was red, and for some reason, namely, I'd had a patient who had this disease once before. I thought maybe this could be flesh-eating bacteria. It was a crazy idea, and it really came out of nowhere, and I couldn't put my finger on why I would really think of such a thing, but the difference between how you treat an ordinary skin infection and how you treat a flesh-eating bacteria is night and day. One, you give antibiotics. The other, you take to the operating room, open up the leg, look inside, and potentially have to do an amputation. And you had the uncertainty of the situation, the fallibility of the situation, comes from three different places. One is, the philosophers have nicely called it just ineptness. That is, the knowledge is out there to know the right answer to the situation, but I just may not have it. And that, fortunately, was not what was going on in the situation. The second reason is simply that the science does not have answers to this question. And that is partly what was going on here, in the sense that science had not provided a clear picture of how to tell the difference between one type of infection and the other. But the third one is the more common one. It is that in certain situations, there is just so much complexity and individual differences from one person to the next that at some level, there is always going to be uncertainty and the possibility of getting a diagnosis wrong. And so you have to live with that, and you have to make decisions in that context. And the decision that I made and recommended and two other surgeons ended up concurring, mainly because there was that hunch that I had that something was really wrong here, made us take her to the operating room instead of just treat her with antibiotics. I won't give away the ending of what happened, but all I can tell you is that it was completely unexpected what we did end up finding. And you find yourself in situations where you just have to make decisions by the seat of your pants, and that is as much an important part of medicine as knowing what all the studies show and what the science tells you.
What if you could end with just sort of a minute of advice to patients? I mean, given the uncertainty of science, what should patients do in relating to their physicians?
I think what we have to understand now is that there's not just an art to being a doctor, but there's an art to being a patient. There are times when you have to ask hard questions, be willing to question your doctor, ask for second opinions. And then there are other moments when you have to be willing to put yourself in the hands of someone else, trust in someone, even understanding that they are ordinary, fallible human beings. And finding the right balance between those two things is why it's an art and not a science to being a patient. It's very important nowadays because we do want appropriately for patients to take much more active roles in the decisions, the major decisions around their own care. And figuring out the best ways to do that is incredibly important. And that takes understanding that if you're the kind of person who is not likely to press very hard or ask questions, well, then that means you do have to press harder and ask questions. If you're finding that in medical situations you're so questioning that you can't seem to trust in anybody, however, then maybe that the way to tune yourself is to understand that you have to at times simply pick the best team you think you can find, and then trust in their judgment to some extent. It's a balance, and you're always trying to weigh where you fall in that spectrum. But it's important to recognize that art of being a patient is how it is you get the best possible care.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Atul Gawande about his book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Uncertain Science. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.